going to read the Lord's Word. Our passage this morning is from Mark 5, 1 through 20, which if you have a seat Bible is on page 840. 840, Mark 5, 1 through 20. And it's our custom at City on a Hill to thank the Lord when we read His Word together. So what we do is at the end I'll say, "This is the Word of the Lord." And you'll all say, "Thanks be to God." They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him any more, not even with a chain, for he had often been bound with shackles and chains. But he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there in the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission. And the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and were drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs, and they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. But he did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy upon you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning. My name is Bland. If you're new today or even last week, hello. I am the lead pastor here and want to welcome you. I was out last week in, I believe it or not, started pastoring when I was 23. It was a small seminary church in outside of Louisville, Kentucky. And so I'm a little older than that now. 41. And so in 18 years of pastoring, I have called in sick twice to preaching, and once was last week. So anyway, I was very, very thankful for Fletcher jumping in quickly with about 12 hours notice or so, and so appreciated that. It's good to be back, feeling good now, and thanks for the prayers and support. Before we get into the message for today, just a couple of quick announcements that want to highlight. Number one is, it's been in the worship guide, but I realize you guys, you have a lot of information. We live in the information age. You get overwhelmed with information, so you may not have even noticed it, but I'm doing a premarital class for those that are, you could be not engaged, but know that you're going to get engaged or engaged, and this is something that I love doing and investing in couples. We've had two couples who have responded. I think there may be more in the congregation. So if you write on the back of your connection card, interested in the premarital class, we will, we're putting all of those together, and we will start that at right after the first of the year. I just want to get everybody in, then we can coordinate the times. So that's a great class, a lot of fun. Enjoy doing that. Also, this year is the first year that we are having our Christmas Eve service. And so really thankful for the opportunity to do that. We're doing it right here at the Driscoll School. So Anybody going to be in town still at that point? Okay, so see a chunk of you. Some of you don't even know yet because of work or whatever. But we'll be having that here, and it'll be a great night at 6 o'clock on the 24th. So come for that. It'll be a great night to invite a friend as well. So then at this time of the year, I also wanted to highlight some of our partners that we have been financially supporting in 2013. One of the things that God has led us to do from the very beginning is to help other church plants around the city. And so in 2013, we've been very strategically involved with church plants around the city, investing in them financially, encouraging them, mentoring them, coaching them. Some of them, one of them came through our church planting residency program. But I just wanted to highlight them because, like, there are just names that get thrown out sometimes. But if you're new to City on a Hill, maybe this fall, then you don't know even our last church planting resident, Charlie Dunn. And so here's a few of them. The first one is Charlie and Abby Dunn, and they are in Southie, and they are leading Hub Church there. And they've established their missional community there, basically like a giant community group. They're sharing life together. Everybody has moved there, is living in the community. They're putting down roots and connecting with folks. So Charlie and Abby are we're definitely deeply involved with them, way beyond just finances, but also in loving and supporting them. They came out of us, and we sent out a core group of about 20 people out of City on the Hill back in August to go help start that. So you can pray for them. Also, Logan and Melissa Keck, who are at Christ the King down in J.P. Roxbury. They are this is a guy who's been in Boston a long time. He was involved with Christ the King in Cambridge, Christ the King in Dorchester, and then felt led to start this church here. We believe that he's got the right heart, the right calling, and even though he's never, I think he's been here one Sunday, we believe in him, believe in what he's doing. So we've financially supported them, ended up sending them a check this year just in God's timing, was right when they needed to buy some equipment for their first service. So we were a blessing in that way to them. And then Joey and Natalie Thompson. Joey is and Natalie are both natives of Boston. Grew up in the area, lived in several of the different communities around the area. Joey drops his R's, which is awesome, and is a great guy. He actually is an electrician by trade and does that and has more contact with people that don't know Jesus through that than any pastor I know. And so he is starting Restoration Road up in Wakefield. They have had their first worship gathering this year. We sent some money to help support them this year. So those are just three, but there's a lot of others that we support as well. And I just share that because we want you to know what our heart is. Our desire is that as we grow, we give away more. Not that we grow and just see how big we can get this thing. We want to give away people. We want to give away resources. We want to be a generous church. And so I share that to say, we're tracking in the last part of the year now. We're 3 weeks out from the end of the year, and financially we're behind on the budget. And so just to encourage you to consider maybe giving an end-of-year gift to help us reach that goal. I will tell you, giving online, if you're going to do that, giving through your checking accounts more direct because we don't pay the fees on your debit card. If you use your debit card, we pay the fees through MasterCard or Visa or whoever you use. And so to maximize your gift, giving a check on a Sunday or giving through your account directly on our website. And you can, if you want to know how to do it, you can go through our website and it has a place where you can give, and it'll give you the basic instructions on that. So I just share those things so that you can give as you feel led. So, all right, now we are in Mark, and we are in a passage that frankly is... is a little freaky, right? I mean, we're talking demon possession. And the truth is, this is the largest text in the Bible on demon possession and exorcism. So it is significant. 2 weeks ago, when I was the last in Mark, we finished up Mark 4, and Jesus had just calmed the storm. He had the disciples were out on the water, and the storm happened. Jesus was asleep. They woke him up, and he literally calmed the wind and the waves in just two words. Today, it's interesting. Jesus leaves the Jewish community. So the Jewish Messiah packs up his Jewish followers and gets on a boat and sails over to a non-Jewish community, a Gentile community, people who did not worship God, who either were under the Roman pantheon of gods or had their own pagan traditions from their families. And Jesus seems to go over there for one purpose, to cast a bunch of demons out of one guy. And what you need to understand is that Jesus didn't do this by accident. Okay, it was on purpose. This is nothing less. Don't miss what's happening in this text. This is nothing less than a battle. This is a showdown of two spiritual forces. One is the demons, and the other is Jesus. And Jesus comes in as the new king, establishing his new kingdom and saying to Satan and his forces who have had dominion and power, you no longer have power where I am, where I speak. The story reveals some powerful truths about evil, though, and this is good for us to reflect on as a culture, because I think we tend to have a very reductionistic view of evil as a culture. And what this text reveals is the complexity of evil, the effects of evil on a man's life, and then Jesus' power over evil, over all evil. So the first is the complexity of evil. Despite being written in the first century, the New Testament takes a multifaceted, multidimensional approach to evil. People look back and they go, oh, well, they just thought demons were into everything. That's not what happens if you actually read the Gospels, which I would encourage you to. If you read the Gospels, you find that evil is not always attributed to a demon or sickness to a demon, that evil is understood to be multifaceted. There are four dimensions in particular, to give credit to Richard Baxter, who's a brilliant Puritan pastor in England in the 17th century. He once preached a sermon on depression, and it was called The Cure of Melancholy and Overmuch Sorrow. We don't write sermon titles like that anymore. It highlighted four different bases for depression, which we would all agree is a type of evil. He says there is a physiological base to depression. That is requiring, in his culture, requiring a change in diet, even in our culture, a proper rest, could require medication. There's a chemical imbalance in play. So that's the physiological approach and understanding of evil. The second one is the moral understanding of evil. This is where evil comes, because there's guilt and shame over personal behavior. And this requires confession, forgiveness, grace. The third one is mental or psychological evil. This is where people are discouraged, emotionally worn out. They're just depressed. In these situations, people need love, they need support, they need talk, they need community. And fourthly, the Bible recognizes that evil can be demonic, that there can be spiritual forces at work. In these situations, people need the gospel, need Jesus, need prayer and the word of God to defeat evil in their life. So what's so striking about the Bible's view of evil? If you look at these four facets or dimensions of evil, why is this so unique? Well, most worldviews don't take this approach. Many worldviews today, even in our culture, are very materialistic. So the response is, in many situations, well, the reason you're feeling this way, we can't kind of pinpoint exactly what's causing this, so it must be physiological, therefore you need medication. Some worldviews see things merely as psychological, that it's not a chemical imbalance. You need therapy, you need talk, you need acceptance. Some worldviews are more moralistic, and this is some even among some Christians, but also among some other faiths as well, that says, you know what your issue is? The reason you're feeling this way is because you have guilt and shame, and you need to stop doing what you're doing. Stop this sin. Stop doing the wrong thing. Start doing the right thing, and you'll get better. Many other worldviews in this world are also actually more spiritual than the Christian worldview. And what do I mean by that? They would say that demons are everywhere. There are cultures in this world that believe spiritual forces are at work all around us in every conceivable way, it seems like. And that the devil's behind whatever's wrong. If it's sickness, Satan's behind that. If it's a bad parking spot at the mall, the devil's behind that. If it's, whatever happens, financial disaster happens, you lose your job, Satan's behind that. And we laugh, but that's actually a a pretty good chunk of humanity that lives in that. You go to Latin America, places like Brazil, where Catholicism is there, but they have this like animism that's there as well, and a lot of fear, dark forces that people are afraid of. Instead of any of these individual approaches, the Bible says these four elements are not mutually exclusive. The Bible recognizes that all of these are at work, and that they might be at work all in one person at the same time. You see, far from looking at somebody's problems and being simplistic and reductionistic and taking some template and going, that's what's wrong with you, the Bible says, no, there could be a lot of different things that are causing what's going on in your life. So in the New Testament, you find, for example, Jesus healed people who were mentally ill. It doesn't say they were demon-possessed. It says that the term in the original language is basically lunatic. It means somebody who's mentally deranged, unstable. And Jesus comes and heals them. Those are people with severe chemical imbalances or whatever it might be that's physiological. Jesus also heals those who were demon-possessed, whose actions happened because they were demon-possessed. He also heals those who were emotionally ill, those who were downtrodden, beaten down by society, beaten down by people around them. So Jesus approaches people based on what's really wrong with them. And so it's rather funny, but we're a modern culture, but they have a more complex understanding of evil than we do in general, even though they're more primitive than us. Oftentimes today, people approach evil as like, well, you know, you're having depression that's either emotional or physiological. It's one of the two. Can't be, you know, really anything else. If we diagnose this guy today, if he were around today, the demoniac, he would no doubt be locked up. We have stronger chains than they had back then. They would lock him up in a padded room and medicate him really heavily. He would. Because we have no categories in our culture for going, there's something at work here that's deeper than just what we see. But it's interesting, Jesus didn't walk off the boat with a prescription pad. Because Jesus knew this guy's problem was not that he was mentally unstable, even though the demons manifested that. It was something much deeper. And honestly, medicating this guy would be like giving morphine to a cancer patient. If we could have hiked him up on some good medication, then yeah, it might have taken the edge off of some of his behavior, but it wouldn't have helped any more than giving morphine to a cancer patient heals them of their cancer. You see, this guy's problem was real and deep, and Jesus knew it. The problem for us is if we move out into this world with less than a fully orbed, complex understanding of evil, If we move out believing our problems are basically physical or basically mental or basically moral or simply spiritual, if you don't see the complexity of evil in life and in this world, it will defeat you. Because you, in essence, have a blind spot in your life. The Bible talks about demons as real personal spiritual forces. Now, what are they? So, because the truth is, Christians don't need to be freaked out by demons. You know, I cannot imagine, I mean, just imagine the disciples at this point. You know, they get off the boat. By the way, it's night. I don't know if you knew that. Back in chapter 4, verse 35, it says evening was coming. And so, this was freaky, okay? I'm just telling you, like, this was not, I don't know if you've ever seen sometimes churches will do, you know, presentations, musicals, or dramas, and they'll have this guy, and he kind of comes up, you know, and acts crazy, but this was at night, near the tombs, and a crazy demon-possessed man runs up to Jesus. That it was freaky. It was like a movie, but real. And what's powerful and important to understand about this is maybe these things help explain and make sense of some of the intransigence and intractability of some people's emotional problems or pervasive problems that don't seem to change because their circumstances change or their medication changes or their therapy changes. What happens is those things don't change even though all of those other things change. Why? Well, it might be. I'm not saying it has to be, but it might be because there's something deeper, a spiritual force that's at work in a person's life. So evil is complex, and we know that. In places like 1 Timothy, Paul tells us, though, that pride in our lives and being basically conceited, being full of ourselves, opens up a place for the devil in our lives. That we can fall under the influence of the devil through our own pride. So now, that's why I'm saying, by not recognizing the multifaceted dimension of evil, you can think, well, I'm just kind of full of myself. Well, yeah, you are, but you're also allowing, you've left your flank open to Satan and his forces to attack you. It also says in the book of Ephesians that anger and bitterness, literally, Paul says, gives a foothold to the devil in your life. You ever had that friend? I had that friend in college. Could not get him out of my dorm room. He would just, and it's like, oh, come on, dude, like, go away. I want to take a nap, you know, or whatever. And he'd come in, and there were times where he'd be standing in the doorway, and I'd like try to shut the door. He'd get that foot in there. Boom, you know, boom, boom, boom. I'd hit his foot. And that's the picture, is that you're basically, you can't shut the door on Satan when you have anger and bitterness in your life. Because you've given him a place to plant his feet. You've given him a beachhead into your life. Ephesians 6:12 recognizes that there are very real spiritual forces at work in this world. And I did a sermon on this back in June, and would just encourage you, if you weren't here at that time, Ephesians 6, we finished up our book, the book of Ephesians, back in June. You can go back and listen to that on our website if you want to learn more about that. But I paint this picture that evil is complex, more complex than we tend to give credit for. But secondly, we see the effects of evil on this man's life in particular. As you think about how evil impacts people, you might have a tendency to look at this demon-possessed man and feel, or demonized man, and feel, well, you know, that doesn't happen to me. That couldn't happen to me. I think that's part of the language we use. We say that somebody is demon-possessed, right? But that's not what this text literally says. The Greek says that he is demonized. It's a verb. And the word demonized is not the same as demon-possessed, right? Demonized means tormented by demons. And when you step back and you realize that Paul said, if you're proud, you give room for Satan. If you're full of anger and bitterness or self-centeredness, you open yourself up to evil forces. You see, you need to stop looking at this guy and go, he's so unrelatable, so unconnectable to me and my life, and instead realize that you have, in your life, opened yourself up to being demonized. Through your own pride, through your own selfishness, through your own anger, through your bitterness, whatever it may be. You see, according to Paul, when you in any way are proud or selfish, to some degree, you are actually being influenced by evil forces. The difference is not of quality, but of quantity. That's the emphasis in this text, by the way. That's why Jesus asks the demon's name. Remember Jesus is omniscient? Okay, we remember that. There were times Jesus in the room and there are people thinking. And he knows what they're thinking. I don't think he's sitting here going, I'm having a problem getting a read on this guy. What is his name? You know, why did Jesus say it, ask for his name? It's very simple. He wanted to demonstrate that this guy was chock full of demons. Now, if the guy had said, my name's Steve, I'd been like, oh, okay, Steve, let's get rid of your demon. Instead, he says, my name is Legion, which is a Roman cohort of up to 6,000 soldiers. Now, people are like, well, that means he had 6,000 demons. No, not the point. The point is, he had a lot. 6,000? I don't think so. I don't think that's the point. The point is, he had a lot, and he wanted to demonstrate that. So Jesus said, tell me your name. Jesus shows up on the shore. And this guy comes to him. And if you stop and look at his life from the understanding of evil that we had just talked about, his life is being consumed by evil. Mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. His life is being consumed. He was a Gentile living in a Gentile land, which meant he was not from a Christian family, as I said. He didn't know the God of the Bible. All he had was the pagan traditions. He was alienated from the loving God of Israel at that point. And evil was literally destroying him. And while this man's life, if you look at it, evil is pervasive, it's powerful, and it's comprehensive in his life. But here's the thing I don't want you to miss, because this might be the greatest secret that evil has for us, or the secret that we can get from this text, and that is this: evil is progressive. Evil is progressive. Evil is progressive. This demoniac, this demonized man, didn't get up one morning, have breakfast, have a bowl of cereal with his family, and in his right mind, clothes, regular job, and go, and 24 hours later, he's crazy, we believe naked or nearly naked, out in the living among the tombs, screaming and cutting himself. That doesn't happen in a day. And no one is born full of demons. Now, there are children who act like demons, but they are not full of demons. Okay? There's no sense that this man was born this way, that it was something that happened to him in his life. The way the text is written, it makes it clear that this man reached this level progressively. Now, why do I say that? Because it says that they could no longer bind him. Which meant at one point they could bind him. So he started going off the deep end, started acting crazy, saying crazy things. The people in the town, he started scaring the kids in the town. They're like, all right, we got to do something with this guy. So they lock him up, and they throw him in the jail or whatever. And a little while later, he seems okay. So they let him out. He starts acting crazy again. They lock him up. Same thing happens over and over again. Now, the chains that they're using to hold him, he literally cannot hold him anymore. So what's happened now is the town has pulled back from him as he's gone out to the tombs and is up on the mountains, running around screaming. They've pulled back and they've said, okay, now we're in avoidance stage. Just avoid the crazy guy. And tell the little kids, don't go out near the tombs. I know you're stupid and you're going to want to go down to the tombs because we said don't go down to the tombs. But there is literally a scary guy. The boogeyman lives at the tombs. And you know there was some dumb kid at that point whose buddy said, oh, I don't think it's real. And, you know, and he went down there and he got scared to death. Because the crazy man came out screaming and cutting himself. Day and night he would wander around talking to himself, cutting himself. People had given up on him. This man who was once at some point in his life at least reasonably normal is now acting in completely insane ways. Satan doesn't advertise that picture when he leads us into sin, though, does he? You too can ruin your life. Here, try this. I'm telling you, you're like, well, duh. He doesn't do it because he knows we're smarter than that. The truth is, he already has the scaffolding in our lives and in our culture, in our world, that he needs to build everything he wants to build. He already has the desires of our culture. He has the desires of the world. He has our own sinful flesh, our own weakness, our own patterns. Listen, I'm not a huge student of, you know, the history of sin for women, but I do understand men in pretty well. I've studied, read, done a lot of conferences, been at a lot of counseling sessions. And it tends to be sin, pride, anger, and money. Sex, pride, anger, and money. Sex, pride, anger, and money. Well, it's not like Satan's got anything else. I mean, that's what he's been doing. Like, if you look at King David. King David looked at a naked woman. Next thing you know, he's killing her husband. Now, if you had gone to David that night as he was standing on the roof, just gazing out and just happens to see Bathsheba bathing and see this beautiful woman, he's basically looking at porn. And if you had looked at him and said, "You're going to kill her husband," at that moment, he'd been like, "Whoa, you're crazy." But the scaffolding was there. David had an area of his life that was unprotected, and Satan took advantage of it. So how is evil progressive in our culture? Just a couple of examples to give you. There are others, but just to give you. One, and I've already alluded to it, is porn. It's been said that internet pornography is probably the number one pastoral problem in the world today. Now, I realize that there are women who struggle with this. So, I mean, it's somewhere around, I think, 25 or 30% of porn users are women. In general, it's still overwhelmingly male, so I'm going to refer to that, but the application is for women as well. But how progressive is evil? I don't know if you knew this or not. The definitive example of that is Ted Bundy. Anybody know who Ted Bundy was? The serial killer? Like, the worst serial killer? Like, you should read the Wikipedia article. Like, this guy was as scary as any person I've ever read about in real life. The night before he was executed, the media was trying to get interviews. He would not do any interviews with anybody except James Dobson, the president of Focus on the Family, which is a Christian organization. He was the only one he granted the interview to. Dobson came in and sat down, 2:30 in the afternoon. Next morning, Bundy is executed. But he talks to Bundy, and Bundy says, why did you let me do this interview with you? And Bundy says, because I want the world to understand how progressively evil pornography is. He goes, I'm not blaming that pornography made me do this, but he says he started from a young age into regular pornography, just nudie magazines, and then got into horrible places, looking at horrible things that led him then to leave pornography and venture into physical manifestation of what he saw. Listen, pornography, I know you're like, well, I'm not Ted Bundy. Yeah, but it does have an effect on you. You can't look at porn and then go pray. You can't look at porn and then go talk to your coworker about Jesus. You can't look at porn and then honor, love, and serve your wife. You can't. Porn is progressive. Listen, GQ magazine recently published an article, 10 Reasons Why You Should Quit Watching Porn. I don't know if you knew this, GQ is not a Christian magazine. We can all confess that if GQ is now coming out against porn, that the evidence against porn is pretty overwhelming. It's not even debatable. It's destructive. It's literally rewiring young men's minds and affecting their ability to even interact with a woman. John Mayer was so into porn for a while. I don't know if he still is. I pray for him. But he actually said at times he would just rather look at porn than be with a real woman. Have you seen who he dates? I mean, these are the super women of our culture. And yet, it's destroyed his way of thinking so much he'd rather look at a computer. It's progressive. It's destructive. Another angle that showing how progressive porn is, there's not a person in here who would sign up to exploit, buy, sell, or exploit helpless women or children. But every time a person views porn, they are participating in and supporting the culture that exploits women, some men, and children. It is. The entire porn industry exists off of exploiting people. Don't tell me that human trafficking does not have satanic forces behind it. It is such an evil thing that anybody with any moral framework at all who looks at it goes, this is evil. That's one of the reasons why they've been able to rally, you know, in our culture, rally people who are from Hollywood or anywhere else to get behind it, because they're like, yeah, that's bad. We shouldn't steal people from their home and then exploit them sexually. We shouldn't make little children, we shouldn't steal the innocence of little children. Listen, I've seen guys lose jobs, marriages, dating relationships destroyed, all from porn. Many are in bondage and feel powerless to overcome it, just like the demonized man was powerless to overcome his sin and his bondage. The good news is there are steps to repentance. There's steps to healing. There's steps to get over it. I've also seen some people who were deeply involved with porn be able to break free from it by God's grace. And there's some steps that can happen. The first one is honestly confession. And not confessing to yourself because you know you have a problem. It's finding another dude or two, your community group, who you can just go, I got a problem. I need some help. You need to get Covenant Eyes software on your computer that somebody's going to get your report. I get about, 17 or 18 reports on Covenant Eyes for 17 or 18 guys. It takes me all of about 10 seconds to look over it and figure out if guys are looking at the wrong stuff. But I do that. And I'll tell you the secret, guys. You're like, well, I don't know. I think I could lie to my friend. Add your mom as your accountability partner. Never seen a dude add his mother or his wife as accountability partner and fail. You do not want to explain that to mom. Okay? I know you're like, oh my gosh. Well, Jesus said if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. That's pretty radical. You need to read. There's Mark Driscoll's free online book, Porn Again Christian, is available. You can download it for free. You need to get in a community group. You need to check out the book, Finally Free, Fighting the Purity and the Power of Grace, Fighting for Purity with the Power of Grace. I'll tweet these and put these on our Facebook page. But there is hope. If there's hope for this guy in this text, there's hope for us, right? I mean, nobody's in here looking at this guy going, yeah, I think I'm worse than him. I think that's why Jesus went to him. There may not have been a human being on planet Earth more chock full of demons than this guy. And Jesus seems to go out of his way, cross the water, go into a Gentile land for this one guy. I love that. So some of you that are like, well, I'm not into porn. Okay, well, self-righteousness is also pretty progressive. Pride, selfish ambition. We just baptize into, oh, I just want to do a lot of things for God's glory. Really, there's none of yourself in there. What if God said your glory was going to be pretty small in this world? I think this time of the year, it's the most wonderful time of the year, it's greed. Greed is our progressive sin of this time of the year. Never had a person come to me and tell me they were greedy. I've had people confess porn, anger, lust, selfishness, whatever. Never heard a person say they were greedy. Why? Because I'm just frugal. I like to save, or you know, I live very much in my means. And the average family budget for Christmas this year is $801. Estimated total this season of spending is $602.1 billion. That's with a B, billion dollars. I'm not against Christmas. I'm not Scrooge, okay? I'm not trying to ruin your Christmas. Don't get anything, you know? I'm simply saying that we have a tendency, every time our income expands, we expand our spending at the exact same rate. Every time we get a raise or a bonus, it's, I get to spend all that or save it for me. Instead of seeing the world, those around us in this community, but around the world as well who live on a dollar or two a day, and recognizing things like the International Justice Mission, which is fighting against human trafficking around the world, and rather than going, you know what, I got a raise, I got a bonus this year, I'm going to give some money to them, I want to help them, you know, I want to give to the church because we're helping church planting around the city, I want to do some things. Rather, we tend to think, what's in it for me? You see, the goal of Satan and his forces is to destroy the image of God. And evil is progressive. So if he can get that foundation, he can build the scaffolding in our lives. Tertullian, the second century Christian writer, once said, the glory of God is man fully alive. The glory of God is man fully alive. which means man fully living out what he was created to do. And when Satan can get hold of that and mar that and pull that down and destroy that image, he can't go into the throne room of God and assault God. So what's the next best thing? Well, destroy the image of God. Destroy man. Destroy mankind. He doesn't care if people know his name or recognize his hand. That's what our modern culture were like. Well, I don't think I see Satan at work. That doesn't stop him. He doesn't care. He is not like a bad guy in the movies, except one. There is one bad guy in the movies who pictures Satan. It's the Joker in Dark Knight. Now go back and watch it. He doesn't care about money. He doesn't care about power. He doesn't care about success. He doesn't care about women. He doesn't care if people know his name. All he cares about is unleashing the depravity and brokenness in mankind so that we destroy and consume one another. He's a perfect example of Satan. I mean, like he does not care. There's no appealing to him. He doesn't want money. He doesn't want fame. He just wants to destroy God's image. And fortunately, the good news in our final point is that the power of Jesus has power over all evil. Jesus has power over all evil. This is a power encounter. What missiologists describe, they see this around the world, especially in frontier missions and places where there's animistic powers. And there, I mean, I've read some crazy stories. I have a friend in Western Mass who's a church planter who's had curses cast on him by Wiccans because he's planted a church and he's telling people about Jesus. Okay, it's real. This is a real world. And this power encounter is where two spiritual forces meet in battle. But it's not really a battle, is it? Immediately, the demons kneel before Jesus. Why? Why did this man run up and kneel before Jesus? Very simply, because the demons knew who Jesus was. The demons knew who Jesus was and that Jesus' power was absolute. It wasn't like they thought, okay, let's muster some strength. We're going to go toe-to-toe with him. No, they're like, there's one option. We have one option. Get on our knees in front of him and plead with him not to cast us out. That's our one option, our one play. He addresses Jesus at the top of his voice. What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Basically, translated in our idiom, what do you want from me? Why are you bothering me? Leave me alone. The demons knew who Jesus was. And it seems like a good thing. You're like, well, the demons possessed, confessed who Jesus was, Son of the Most High God. That's good, isn't it? Not really. Because in the ancient world, identifying a spirit being by name, was considered a way to go gain control over it. This demon-possessed guy was basically trying to cast Jesus out. He was trying to get his, I know who you are, you don't have power over me. And I love it, he actually pleads to God. He goes, I adjure you by God. The demon names God and cites God. This is, by the way, using God's name in vain. Because this demon didn't use God's name because he wanted to worship God. He uses God's name to try to trump Jesus. I adjure you by God. Do not torment me. In the book of Matthew, the same story adds, before the appointed time. You see, Jesus knew, the demons knew that Jesus had the power over them and that one day when he comes back and judges the world, he's going to take Satan and his forces and cast them into the lake of fire. And so they're like, not now, Jesus, not now. Please, not now. Jesus wanted to know the man's name, as I said, because he wanted people around them. He wanted the disciples to witness that this wasn't a one-demon guy, this wasn't a two-demon guy, this wasn't a three-demon guy, a seven-demon guy. This was a guy who was had more demons than could be counted. And just like calming the storm, I love this, Jesus doesn't start sweating. He doesn't look at the guy and start rolling up his sleeves to, you know, to get the power going. He doesn't call on God. God, cast this demon out. He simply speaks, get out. And the demons do, and they cast into the pigs. Why the pigs? Because the pigs, if there was one demon per pig, and there was a ton of pigs, that was the symbol. That was visually, whoa, and visually that they've left this man. Jesus' kingdom is a full-on assault of Satan's kingdom. Jesus isn't here to negotiate with satanic forces or demons. He's here to destroy the power of the strong man and set people free from the power of evil. The responses to Jesus' power over evil are pretty clear. The local crowd fears him. We don't have categories for this. We don't understand this. We can't make sense of this. Let's ignore him. Let's get him out of here. We don't want him around. It's so crazy to see someone transformed like Jesus did, but because they had no categories and they had blinders on, they could not see that God had visited them. Instead, they flee. The Pharisees, in other situations, dismissed Jesus as a magician or simply a demonic exorcist. But the man who was cleansed, look at verse 15. It says that basically and they came to Jesus, the town did, and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there clothed, which is why we think he was naked, because the text says he was clothed now. Clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And then down in verse 18, and he was getting into the boat. The man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. One of the most beautiful little phrases, I think, in the Gospels, when I think about what this man had been delivered from, is that he begged that he might be with him. Jesus had set him free, and all he wanted was to be with Jesus. And Jesus had a mission for him, though, to carry the gospel, the good news, to his people. Truth is that the demoniac is a picture of humanity. The demoniac's a picture of humanity apart from the grace of God. John Calvin said, though we are not tortured by the devil, yet he holds us as his slaves, till the Son of God delivers us from his tyranny. Naked, torn, and disfigured, we wander about till he restores us to the soundness of mind. Now, while we're sitting here right now and we're all hopefully in our right mind, our sin is seeing our sin and understanding our sin as the suicidal foolishness against our own Creator. Then you can begin to see how while you may not be demonized, it's not quantity, the quantity is different, but the quality is not. We are unclean like the demoniac. We can no more save ourselves and purify ourselves than the demon-possessed man could have come down off the mountains, put his clothes on, and sat down and had dinner with his family. It cannot happen, and it cannot happen in our own power. So Jesus came instead to take on the forces of darkness and hell. He took on our sin on the cross, defeated Satan, drank every last drop of our guilt. It's interesting, the demoniac cut himself because of the demons, but Jesus, in his love, let himself be beaten, bruised, nailed, and pierced. on our behalf. The demoniac went among the tombs driven by the demons. But Jesus went to the cross and into the tomb and rose on our behalf. Until you understand that you are the demonized man, you will not treasure the cross rightly. Until you understand that you cannot save yourself, you will not experience salvation in Christ. Until you accept that you are powerless in the face of Satan, sin, and death, you will continue to be a victim of those forces. This text is a message to us that Jesus is our only refuge. And as we celebrate Advent, we think about his coming and the brokenness of the world that we're in. And yes, the spiritual forces that we see at work in people's lives, destroying entire groups of people. We're reminded that Christ came to break that power. We're going to take communion to celebrate the death and the resurrection of Jesus on our behalf to set us free. And the good news is, just like Jesus traveled across the sea to free this man, Jesus came to free us from our sin, to free us from our brokenness, to free us from our guilt and from the power of Satan. We're going to take the bread and the cup as the symbols of Jesus' body and blood broken and poured out for us. If you're not a Christian, this is the only part of the service we'd ask you to not partake, not be a part of, because this is for those who have been born again, who are celebrating what Christ has done for them. We'd love for you to meet Jesus. We'd love for you to put your faith in Jesus and trust in him and believe that he can free you from sin and free you from the guilt and free you from the power of sin and death. As we take the bread and the juice, Fletcher says, "During Christmas, the rest of the world drinks to forget, but we drink to remember. We drink to remember what Christ has done for us." Let's all stand together. I'm going to pray, and then we'll move into our time of response. Jesus, thank you for this story of you seeking out one man who Satan had a grip on like maybe no other. A man the world had written off as hopeless and helpless. But you saw him through the eyes of love, through the eyes of grace, and with your power, you came. You came and defeated the enemy to show us that on the cross, once and for all, you would defeat our great enemy. Thank you for that hope today, Jesus. As we take the bread and we take the cup, we give you thanks and we remember and we long for the day that you will return for us. In your name.
As we take communion, we want to encourage you in this time, especially if you feel that you've been struggling with sin, especially ones that were mentioned. But even if there is grief in your heart, if there is something in your life that you can't seem to shake off, take this time to pray and ask the Lord for help.